Hi, I'm Ewa Górska, and this is Reground, a podcast about the spaces where justice, geography, and power collide. In each episode, I talk to researchers and scholars whose work uncovers the hidden geographies of control, resistance, and belonging. Let's reground the conversation together. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Ewa.
My guest today is Dr. Mark Griffiths, political geographer whose research explores military ecologies, weapons supply chains, the aftermaths and beforemaths of war, and the making and unmaking of colonial space. His current work focuses on the effects of militarism in Palestine and Iraq. And this is also what I would like to talk about, which is your latest book, which is called Checkpoint 300, Colonial Space in Palestine, and was published just this year in 2025 by University of Minnesota Press. So let's talk about the book.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Thanks for reading it and being interested in it.
I haven't read it yet.
Oh, okay. Well, thanks for reading the title.
And the names of the chapters.
Oh, sorry.
Yes. And I will read it. It's just that we didn't plan it very well, unfortunately. But okay, let's focus on Checkpoint 300. So what I've been thinking about when I was thinking about questions for this podcast was that I know what Checkpoint 300 is because I crossed it many times, both ways, from the occupied Palestinian territories, the West Bank, to occupied East Jerusalem. But let's say it's Israel, or is it under Israeli, direct Israeli control. But I think if I was to explain it to people who've never been to Palestine or never crossed it, or even where to Palestine but never crossed this checkpoint, it's maybe not so easy for me to know how to explain it. Also because I think the name might be a bit misleading. And in Arabic, it's not called a checkpoint. It's called a border crossing, which I suppose it's more of a border crossing than a road checkpoint that we can find on almost any road in occupied West Bank. So how would you describe it if you were to describe it to people who've never been there?
Well, I mean, as you know, but you know, other people may not know, it's a large border crossing between Jerusalem and Bethlehem, two very important sites of Palestinian life. It controls the movement of thousands of Palestinians, West Bank Palestinians, not just from Bethlehem, but from, you know, the southern part of the West Bank. Why it's significant is because while the checkpoints, which are still important, can be sort of maybe a concrete block and a soldier, this one in 2005 was updated to terminal status, as the Israeli authorities put it. And there are a few of them around, Kalandia notably to the north, which is between Ramallah and Jerusalem. And what that means is that the Israeli state has put in a lot of capital to render this border crossing as something like an airport. It has lots of corridors, turnstiles, biometric checks, etc. So it's become something that can handle large numbers of people traveling between Bethlehem and Jerusalem. And every day, at least before, you know, the current genocidal war that's paused at the moment, hopefully that it's paused forever, it was handling something like 7,000 or 8,000 people going through every morning in sort of crowded, pretty terrible conditions, which probably a lot of people know about. I could say something about it's the way that it can be conceptualized as a border crossing, because, and I think this is a really important point to make, and it's made early in the book, that this shouldn't be seen as a crossing between Palestine and Israel, or occupied territories and Israel, because as you know, Ewa, like, you're going between two bits of Palestinian land, however you conceptualize it. So that even once you go from the Bethlehem part through to the Israeli side, of course, both sides are ultimately controlled by Israel in many ways, you're still within the Green Line, or at least on the Palestine side of the Green Line, which is supposedly the line between the occupied territories and the state of Israel, recognized, internationally recognized. It's still 2 kilometers to the north, so it's all built on Palestinian land, however you conceptualize the idea of Palestinian land.
And then you also go to East Jerusalem, which technically also is Palestinian land, just annexed illegally by Israel. So again, as you say, whatever way we will look at it, it's still inside Palestine, basically.
Yeah. So, I mean, always careful not to talk about this being a border. It's a border mechanism. It's definitely a border crossing, but it's not a border between occupied Palestine or Palestine and Israel.
But it's also, if we even look at it that way as border crossing, it was always, I don't know how to describe that feeling, maybe a bit of surprise, even though I crossed it so many times, that it always works one way. So you're checked if you go from the occupied Palestinian territories inside Israel, to simplify it. But if you're going back from Israel back to the West Bank, you just go around basically the terminal, or if you're on a road in a car, you just go through.
Yeah.
And it takes you 3 minutes maybe.
Yep.
While you, if you want to cross from the occupied West Bank into Israel, then you're checked on every level and it might take you 3 hours.
Yeah.
Especially if you're a Palestinian, then maybe longer even.
Yeah. I mean, since the biometric gates have been put in, apparently it's a little bit shorter, but it can still take an hour, 2 hours, and the queues form from early in the morning. And as you mentioned, I think it's an important point. People going by car, who can go by car? You know this already, you know this for sure. But you can go by car only in an international car, doesn't happen, or Israeli plates with Israeli plates, so the yellow number plates, so you can drive back and forth. And that is, you know, usually Jerusalemite or Palestinian citizens of Israel who've got that kind of car or internationals, and they can drive back and forth pretty easily. That part of the checkpoint is like 100 meters to the east. What this is focused on is the bit where you have to walk through. So all West Bank Palestinians have to go through the walking part, and therefore be subject, you know, to these queues, these, the stress and the checks and the presence of soldiers and private security guards, all of that stuff.
So maybe let's also talk and explain a bit about who are those West Bank Palestinians, because in general, it's not like every West Bank Palestinian can cross into Israel. You need to have permits. Sometimes those permits are just for Jerusalem. Sometimes those permits are for the 48, so the land controlled by the State of Israel or considered a State of Israel. But it's mostly labor force, and to put it bluntly, and maybe not diplomatically, but that's basically cheap labor for Israel, right?
Yeah, I think cheap labor is a really important critical term to be used, because states or dominant economies use cheap labor to fund their economic growth. So the, at least, I mean, again, we're going back before October 2023, but the state would issue permits according to the needs of the economy. So typically, Palestinian men would be given permits to work in construction and agriculture. They were the two main ones. So therefore, you get this pretty terrible circle where the Palestinian men are going to provide cheap labor to build the settlements on Palestinian lands at the front line of the occupation. But, you know, they can earn up to 5 times more than they can earn in the West Bank. So, of course, you know, there's no judgment on them. So that's who can generally pass through. It's generally, especially in the, those busy early morning times, which start, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning through till 8, 9, it's a, just a mass of people trying to get through, sort of bottlenecks into the checkpoint. There are plenty of videos online.
And photos. Like, I think there are those iconic photos that I usually use in my presentations if I ever talk about checkpoints. And it's like, it's still dark, it's early morning, I think it's cold, like people are wearing jackets, and you can see that some people, and especially children who are trying to get to school, are like one level higher up, because they're walking on a wall holding two metal bars to just cross faster over heads of other people, basically. And it's just a metal cage filled with people. Also, like in Kalandia, but Palestinians often describe it as being, you know, like a cattle in a cage.
Yeah, it's often compared to sort of an abattoir. So those morning periods, I mean, my guess would be that it's 99% men. 99% men of a working age. And to get a permit and to maintain a permit, and for a Palestinian man, I mean, there are certain rules that, as is quite common, they're not written down, but you know, you need to be of working age, not too young, not too old. So, you know, below the age of 30 may not get one, above the age of 50 may not get one. If you've been involved in political activity or activism, or been in an Israeli jail, which is very easy for a Palestinian man to be in Israeli jails, as we know, you won't get a permit. And then there are a couple of other rules too, that generally you won't be given a permit if you're not married and you don't have a child, which changes the gendered aspect of the checkpoint, which I know you might want to talk about. And so there are all these ways that Israel permits certain people to pass and therefore doesn't permit other people to pass through the checkpoint.
I want to talk about the gender aspect, and we can do it now. But first, why no permits for unmarried men?
Well, I mean, you can speculate, but as is quite common, the state of Israel doesn't write a lot of this stuff down. But if they're not married, if they don't have kids, I think the state of Israel would judge them to be less likely to be terroristic. Or less likely to be engaged in, you know, political activities, political violence.
Interesting. Probably better answer than I had in my head, because my first thought was that they also won't get in a relationship or get married to a Jerusalemite and try to obtain, maybe in the future, if that would be possible, for example, a Jerusalem or Israeli ID.
I mean,
which is, again, not easy to do, but...
Yeah, my answer is sort of speculative, and what I've heard from people talking in Bethlehem. Your answer is as good as mine. The only thing I'd say with that is, if a West Bank Palestinian and a Jerusalemite Palestinian want to get married, the state of Israel just says, "Yeah, fine, you go and live in West Bank."
Yeah.
So in that sense, they'd encourage West Bank Palestinians to come and couple with non-West Bank Palestinians. So yeah, if you haven't been there, you realize if you step away, all of it sounds like quite daunting to try to understand these different like gradations or hierarchies of being Palestinian, and therefore fragmentation. We've not even mentioned the diaspora around the world as well. So
yeah, and we're just focusing on one checkpoint in one specific place, while sometimes not the same rules will apply at different checkpoints and different parts even of the West Bank, for example. Okay, so let's stay with the gendered aspect. We talked a bit about men, but I think I would stay there a bit longer, because my question is also, or my feeling always was, that there's something very degrading for men, Palestinian men, when they're treated like... Well, it's degrading for any human being to be treated like cattle or animals, but I think also there's something about trying to socially control, psychologically control Palestinians and Palestinian men, but just somehow taking away their agency, I guess.
Somebody like Helga Talsori writes about this kind of thing, where Palestinians who are in those security situations, if that's what we want to call them, they get home and they don't have time for political thoughts, don't have time to organize, don't have time to do anything. So cultural life, political life, social life, and family life is curtailed, because you're getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning, doing a long day on a construction site, getting home at 6 or 7, barely seeing your family, barely seeing your kids, sleeping, do it all again, 6 days a week. What does that leave for the fabric of Palestinian culture? If you sort of zoom out and have like an overview of this. So doubtless that's the case. That, I mean, I don't really speak about or try to think about Israeli intentions. I want to think about effects, and this is a real effect, whether it's intended or not, sort of by the by, that's an effect.
And what about the women?
I always hesitate to talk about Palestinian women, but I need to say I've worked a lot with feminist researchers and women in and around Bethlehem, constructed these findings very carefully. And there are two ways I think we should think about this checkpoint specifically in women. One is that obviously they're not granted permits in the same way as men are. They might apply for labor permits. They might apply to do cultural activities, sometimes through churches, especially if you're Christian, and they're very likely to be refused. When they do get permits, it's often as for medical appointments and to accompany others on medical appointments, or it's a prayer maybe during Ramadan. And so who gets mobility and who gets to go to Jerusalem? The outline of it is drawn by the state, or the Israeli state, in that the only permissible mobile woman is one who gives care and one who prays. So you've got a, you know, like religious caring woman. So it's constructing gender in a specific way. If you want to go there for a business activity as a woman, you can't do that. Or if you want to go there to, I don't know, to for a cultural, a leisure, a day of leisure or a cultural pursuit or to study, then you can't do that. So you're, you get to see the, how gender is, like the contours of gender are drawn by checkpoint permits, etc. And the second way, the second main way I would say, so I mentioned that for the men to maintain a permit they or get a permit, they should be married and have one child. And what that means is for the thousands of men you see there in those crowds, the photos that you mentioned, the videos that you mentioned, is there's at least one woman and at least one child at home. Which of course means that there's more domestic labour taken on by women. And that's not to say that, you know, deny the presence of Palestinian patriarchy. Like, there's a patriarchal culture, just like cultures all over the world are patriarchal.
Exactly.
I'm not saying without the checkpoint everything would be perfect, but it's exacerbated. That's undoubted. So women might have to cook more or clean more or take on more duties with the kids, etc. I mean, you say might, it just happens that way.
I think maybe I would also add, you said that before, but just to connect the dots, that many of these men are not from Bethlehem, so they actually have to travel, for example, from Hebron al-Khalil, which is like at least an hour away.
Yeah.
So to be at the checkpoint at 3 or 4 at night, they actually have to leave earlier and they come back after, it's not like 8 hours at work. No. It's often longer, especially construction sites. And then they have to come back. Okay, they cross quickly, but then they have to get a bus, go back home.
Yeah. And in my research, you find wives, husbands, couples talking about, I never get time to spend with the kids because I'm in either in the checkpoint or I'm at work. And then also the women's talking about how, you know, men can come home agitated and nervous about the next day, or they're absent, or the women are worried about them while they're at work. They get up and they make breakfast twice, or the kids, all the duties around schooling and the kids and helping with homework fall on the mums. And of course, it makes it harder for them if they want to pursue jobs or careers or studies. They're more closely tied to the home than they would be if it wasn't set this way.
Can we also maybe mention, try to go through the checkpoints? Because we both crossed it. I don't know how about you. I crossed it before the biometrics and after. I don't exactly remember how it looks right now, but as you said, corridors, gates, you put your luggage on this conveyor belt, they scan it. And then if you're international, if you're white, if you have a European passport, that goes pretty quickly and usually no one really gives a damn. It's also not like if you have a scanner for your luggage, there's a live person. No, they do it from their office somewhere else. So you don't even see anyone, but there might be a voice in loudspeaker saying something to you. And then you have those booths like at the airport where Palestinians scan their permits and I guess IDs. And as a foreigner, I think it's still the system that we go to a sideline. And there are some live soldiers or border control there checking the passport, usually not very nice, and often not really looking and not checking, and they don't care. But I also often have seen that Palestinian permits wouldn't work in that biometric scanner for some reason. And I remember the stress. I remember people either being late for work or studies or whatever else they had in Jerusalem, or traveling in, for example, as a family. Also women, for example. So maybe they were taking care of someone. And I remember the stress and also the young soldiers with weapons coming to check.
Yeah.
Usually not very nice. So even, you know, even if we are privileged going through there, I always felt very stressed and I can't really imagine doing that as Palestinian.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a very common experience of Europeans, white Europeans, of course, or visitors from the outside who go to sites where there's an Israeli military or security presence. And it's a completely different experience, and that lays bare the racialization of it, that simply because of the way I look, I can walk through there more or less. I was astounded the first time I went there, and I'm sure you were too. Like it's shocking that you and me are from a place that's nothing to do with Britain does have a lot to do with Palestine, but in a different way.
Some could say you're responsible.
and that I could just walk through there, then a Palestinian born in Bethlehem or born in Jerusalem can't do that. That was really the genesis of the research, to know more about that and to understand why that's in place and what its effects are, broader effects.
Okay, so you conceptualize it using framework of colonial space. So we basically are talking about it all the time, but how does Checkpoint 300 exemplify a concept of colonial space? Why is it the case or that was your case study?
Well, if you ask a geographer to talk about space, it could be a long answer.
What is space?
I mean, what I'll say, I'll try to be succinct, is that try to understand the way that space is connected on many different levels. So you've got the space of the checkpoint that we just spoken about, which is the, you know, corridors, turnstiles, biometric tests, etc. It's a really important space. It's what everybody focuses on. But then we can start to link it to other spaces and see how they articulate. Like one depends on the other. For example, the home, like the domestic space. Those men wouldn't be in that space if women weren't doing, to simplify it, the women weren't doing that work at home. So you get, if it goes out into different parts of Bethlehem, different parts of the West Bank, like you said. We did our research in Batir and Walaja, so you can see how it goes into the villages west of the centre of Bethlehem. And then you start to think about, well, what kind of technologies are there? Like you said, there's a scanner that's the same as the scanner that you go through at your local airport. It's made by the same company. So you start to try to understand how those companies are making money off military occupation, illegal military occupation, and also in so-called civil settings. And that's another space. So just to give one example, the biometric or the facial recognition technologies were developed, the ones that are used now are developed in the university in the UK and then sold or used in the West Bank at checkpoints. And that's also now sold used in casinos in Las Vegas and sports stadiums in London. So you have these other spaces like PhD research or a postdoc in a UK university with a scholarship doing research, just like you and I have done research, but then it's going to these effects, like facial recognition in a checkpoint on stolen land. So trying
controlling occupied people who are being colonized.
Yeah, and I tried to talk about it without getting mad, and now I'm getting so you start to understand colonial spaces as multiple too. I think we know this a lot more now. I mean, we think of it more automatically a lot more now with the war on Gaza, where lots of activists and also non-activists, like anybody of conscience, recognizing international complicity in Israel's genocidal war. And so we know that colonial space is multiple. So it goes from the checkpoint facility, the sort of intimate or immediate space, to the home. Also, we could think about the wider effects on the northern parts of Bethlehem, the closed businesses, the residential areas that are depopulated, and then into, you know, a tech park in Arizona or a university in the UK. Or it's highly depressing.
It is.
It does not make one feel good. But so to answer your question succinctly, just trying to give an account of colonial space and how it's multiply formed and also contested. It's not all one way, and works on different scales that articulate with each other. See, I told you I could go on and on.
Yeah, and very academically.
Sorry.
No problem. Violence, that's what I was thinking about. Like, at the first glance, it seems all very neat. I mentioned a soldier with gun, but in general, the soldiers or border guards are not really visible around there. You have the biometrics, the corridors. It's all to control people, but without really being in direct contact with them, really, especially right now with new technologies. But how can we think about it as still being violent?
Well, I mean, we could do violence on different levels again, but
Let's go that way, please.
I mean, is it violence to stop somebody being mobile between two places that they grew up in? I would say it's. And does that affect their education? Does it affect their health, like their access to healthcare? I would say it is. So even from the very beginning, whether there's a soldier with a gun out pointed at you or something that feels a little bit more subtle, it's a violence, a form of violence. And we could also look at the sort of domestic geographies. If it means, I don't want to exaggerate it, but if it means you see less of your parent or your father, how does that affect you? Could that be termed or thought of as a form of violence? Because you can be sure that the route that goes to the west through the Beit Jala, which you know probably, the highway, mm-hmm. the settlers' highway, where people can drive from settlements around Bethlehem and Hebron to Tel Aviv in, I don't know, 40 minutes?
Yeah.
And without being stopped.
Just to maybe explain it a bit better, from Jerusalem to the West Bank, you can go quickly in two ways. One is checkpoint 300. You can drive through with a car if you have, of course, if you have a car that can drive in Israel. And you're basically in the city center of Bethlehem. But if you're going to the Southwest Bank, and especially if you're going to a settlement in Southwest Bank as a settler, you will usually use the highway that goes around Bethlehem, crosses through a tunnel under Beit Jala, which is a Palestinian city connected to Bethlehem. And then you can either go into Beit Jala and from there to Bethlehem or go to the Southwest Bank.
Yeah. I mean, what I was saying is that if you are a settler, I'm going to say just illegal settler because they're illegal and under international law, and we need to keep saying that over and over again. You don't have to give away that time of your day. So you are able to have those commitments at home, that social life, that political life, that family life. You do get to have that. So I would call that violence. Like that's an apartheid. That's how apartheid works. But I would say if you want to think about more visible violence, it's there too. Like, as you know, that part of northern Bethlehem is a place where you have Palestinians protesting, often young men protesting occupation. Often they've got stones, sometimes Molotov cocktails. And I don't really know if they ever have anything much more than that. And then behind the gate that opens, that's just next to the checkpoint, a few hundred meters down, you have the IDF, the soldiers that come out, or border police, and they've got everything from skunk water to tear gas to rubber bullets, non-lethal weapons that, of course, aren't always non-lethal. And so you have time and time again, there's many, many instances of where that whole space is transformed into urban battle space. So you can find all kinds of violence at that site.
Plus the wall that's in there all around.
Yeah.
Built around the checkpoint and Rachel's tomb.
Yeah, Rachel's tomb's key to it, yeah.
Yeah. Can you explain that?
Quickly.
I haven't been inside, so I also somehow I don't know so much about it.
Yeah, I mean, Rachel's tomb is key. I'll tie myself in a minute. So Rachel was a matriarch of, I might get a bit of it wrong, but she's a matriarch of the Abrahamic religions, and all of the patriarchs are buried in Hebron, apart from one, and that's Rachel. She's buried by the side of the Hebron Road, which is in northern Bethlehem.
Which used to connect Hebron through Bethlehem to Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Ancient track.
And it's where Checkpoint 300 is built.
Exactly.
I'm sure people can imagine the whole thing now. There are photos in the book, photos and maps in the book. So
exactly. Or Google.
She was buried there. Did she? And so when they were agreeing or negotiating the path of the wall, there was a last minute intervention and Israel decided they wanted to have Checkpoint 300. So when you see the wall that goes around Bethlehem, the famous wall that everyone's seen, it's like 10 meters, I'll get those two mixed up. It goes around the northern edge of Bethlehem, but then it dips in, takes Rachel's tomb and dips back out again. And it creates this very strange geography, which is quite unusual apart from in Hebron, of a Israeli settlement right inside or in the center of urban Palestinian space, which you don't get anywhere else. And so you have these two communities living side by side, but they can't see each other, of course, but they could be no less than 10 or 20 meters apart. And that's Rachel's tomb. And there's now like a religious school connected to it. There's a permanently based IDF soldiers protecting those settlers that live there. And so Rachel's tomb is hugely important to understand the geography of northern Bethlehem and the checkpoint. Was that succinct enough?
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. I was just thinking also about tourist movement, that we have both tourists coming to Bethlehem.
Uh-uh.
They either come with organized groups with a tourist guy who can't really talk and explain the wall and the checkpoint because he would be fired and lose license in Israel. So you have those buses coming in and then people being just rushed to Christian sites, the church, okay, back to bus. But you also have a lot of tourists who are coming on the Israeli side to Rachel's tomb. And these tourist like flows are totally separated. They are not the same people. They don't see each other. It's like two different worlds that are 2 meters or 3 meters apart from each other.
Yeah. I mean, I've never been to Rachel's tomb.
I'm not sure if we can go there. I think we could, but...
I'll be careful what I say, but I've got some photos from... Might cut that, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I haven't been to Rachel's tomb, but there are some photos in the book from inside the complex. Somebody I know went there and took some photos. On those tourists, I think they're two separate... They're definitely separate tourists. I think the ones who go to Rachel's tomb are much more religiously orientated or ideologically orientated. What you see in Bethlehem, I mean, this is a bit of an aside from the book, and you'll have seen them too. This is, actually tells something about Checkpoint 300. They come on the buses, they go to the big hotels in Bethlehem, and I don't think they realize they're passing into, well, it's, I mean, occupied territory, but they're passing into the West Bank. They sort of go through quite smoothly, park in their nice hotels, go to see where Jesus was born, and some of them even walk around with a Jerusalem Israel hat on, which is highly offensive and really inappropriate, but they're just...
Everyone ignores them.
Yeah, and so they go around Manger Square, have a falafel, and then they go back to Jerusalem.
I'm not sure if they have falafel. Some of them, when I've seen them, because they often park or used to park in a central bus station in Bethlehem, and then they would rush through, and the women would cover their hair, which like normally no one does in Bethlehem, but the guides tell them so, and they're scared. They were always scared.
Yeah, I mean, wow, it's really scary. Sorry, that was
a joke.
I know,
the best falafel is really scary.
I mean, all jokes aside, it does show how these clueless tourists, on a package deal probably, can travel so freely around the land whose people aren't able to.
Yeah.
If I can put it simple, in simple terms.
And they're also privileged enough to cross so smoothly that they don't have to even know what they're crossing and where they are, just
I wonder if there's a word for separate systems on the same land.
Yeah, I had also one more thought on violence and biometric systems. It's the privacy of Palestinians that is being basically stolen. No one asks, like we're used to in Europe, that everything is GDPR protected. Like we have to think about every signature, every bit of data we collect, and whatever we do, we have to sign a separate piece of paper agreeing to how our personal data will be processed. And in Palestine, especially if you're Palestinian, especially if you want to have a permit and go to the Israeli site and go through checkpoint, there is no privacy, there is no rules when it comes to data that is being collected. We know that Israelis are using a lot of systems now empowered by AI to just collect pictures of faces, biometric data, scanning the IDs, everything they can on these people, and just no one can basically say no.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about data protection because I feel like there are 100 other problems, but this is definitely a long-term problem. And we've seen recently that Israel's deal with, I've got it all wrong now, Microsoft, Google,
Yeah, I mean, violence, and I think that's actually important when it comes to privacy, because now we also know that those apps and programs Israel uses, especially with facial recognition, are now used automatically, managed by AI, for example, in Hebron. And even weapon systems now are being connected to that. It's also all over Jerusalem. If you go into the old city of Jerusalem, if you go to East Jerusalem, it's municipality cameras, security institutions cameras, settlers cameras, and they all collect data. So then Palestinians can be recognized.
Yeah.
If they do something that the Israelis want to arrest them for example, or if they don't. But they are just all that, like, the Big Brother is watching nonstop. And if you look around, especially right now, well, I was there 2 years ago, but in Jerusalem, the cameras are everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, we might not know what they're going to do with it, but we can be really sure it's not going to be anything good. To do that, to have those capacities, it needs that international complicity. You know, as we've seen recently with big tech, like pulling out of cooperation with the IDF after pressure, these things can't happen just within the state of Israel and its tech, in this example, in its tech sector. And so these facial recognition cameras, or, I don't know, these databases that can hold millions and millions of phone calls, they really signal to us where we can make a difference, where we can put pressure on companies to cut their contracts with these, especially... No, I mean, always when it's to do with occupation. But companies don't want to be associated with genocidal warfare or, you know, war crimes, crimes against humanity in general.
In general.
Some of them do. So I think this is really an important point, actually, that tracing those lines of supply, of innovation, of capital exchange, all those exchanges is really important. It's the best thing we can do from outside as non-Palestinians, you and me especially. That's the one conclusion I've come to.
And I like that conclusion, but I don't want to finish the episode yet, even though it's a great conclusion to finish with. I have one more question, I guess more connected to your book. We spoke a lot on how the checkpoint and crossing the checkpoint affects Palestinian daily life, but... Do Palestinians, or how do Palestinians resist or remake the space around them and try to reshape it?
I mean, the question of contesting or remaining Palestinian agency is really key. And it's something that I try to hold on to, remain open to, not just in this work, but throughout the way I think, try to think about Palestine colonial space in general. And Palestinians around... Well, as you know too, like, that space is still importantly Palestinian. So I could just give a few examples. What's happened in northern Bethlehem is nothing short of terrible. But let's say businesses have adapted or residents have adapted. So where a restaurant used to be a place where on Sundays families would go and have a nice meal, now it could be a place that caters for commuters. It's also true that old fruit groves, olive groves have been cut down and paved over and they've become car parks. So you pay like 10 or 15 shekels and there's a desk and there's lots of, which of course is ecologically a disaster, but it's a sign of adapting. So the economy can continue, you know, just people can earn some money and get by. So there is this adaptation, like Palestinian agency doesn't disappear. Or, you know, just in the vicinity, there's Jasser Palace that does amazing cultural activities that you're probably familiar with.
Only if parties underground, but maybe that's for a different story.
Well, it also does important cultural activities ever. right there, you know, teaches how, like, I think they call it agri-resistance, how to plant things in soils that have been contaminated. And then they'd have sessions where people from Ida camp can come and learn how to do that. Like, that is a form of political agency that continues in the context. This is the most teared back gassed site in the whole world. You know, living there is really in the vicinity of occupation. If people can imagine the famous and Watchtower, which I think is the, I'd be interested to know what you think, actually. I think it's the most photographed non-religious site in all of Palestine. That watchtower that goes over the roundabout where the roads fork off.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I actually put that on the cover of an episode of Reorient Podcast on the 56th episode cover. And I just found it and was thinking, because at that moment, I don't know what's painted or what's the graffiti there right now, but it was Trump kissing that tower.
Yeah, well, I guess it changes all the time.
Yeah, but it felt, it was from the time when he moved American embassy, the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. But now it felt, well, that episode, I published it on 15th of October. So just after, let's hope forever, but still not treating Palestinians are equal. It's still colonial, ceasefire deal, whatever.
Yeah.
But it's just so still a great illustration. So I think it's not only one of the most photographed iconic sites, but also one of that's constantly being used to paint and repaint and tell a story by visuals, which I also think is agency of maybe not only Palestinians. There's a lot of international artists. Yeah.
Some of them really bad.
That Trump is also not the best, but
Nadia Maj, I have to mention, who's the photographer who took a lot of the photos in the book, the good ones. And he also did a lot of the interviews. There's a great photo that he took of that and of other things in the book. Going back to what I was saying is that, you know, Palestinian Agency continues and tried to hold on to that without glorifying, because there's no point in glorifying, without romanticizing. But of course, Palestinian Agency continues in northern Bethlehem and all over Palestine. I mean, it's not just about willing it, imagining it to be, and it's just a fact. So, and it's the thing we need to hold on to, you know?
We are a minority, but still there are some thousands Muslims, and we have to teach them.
Who are the Tatars in Poland? And how do they carve out their lives in Polish society?
Sometimes it's too many things, too many jobs for one guy. Tomorrow I need to go to work, and between my work I need to go to prepare some guy who died 2 days ago, because I need to prepare him to last journey.
There is this time when you are afraid, and then you come out, and then everything is okay, because they know you as, his name is Adam, they know you as Adam, not as Muslim, not as Tatar, because you are Adam.
And is Islam here in Poland different from somewhere else?
What's going on? They just come out from the mosque, and now they're kissing each other, men, women. What's going on?
These are more than academic questions. There are also questions about the ways that Muslims are part of Europe. I'm looking at little books, old books, that are almost falling apart. And they are written in Arabic. I do know Arabic, but here are texts I cannot decipher. I am Moritz Berger, professor of Islam in the West at Leiden University in the Netherlands.
And I am Ewa Górska, an assistant professor at the Digital Justice Center at the University of Wrocław in Poland.
I want to show Maurits the newest chapter in history of this part of Europe. So I guide him behind the trees to the back of the cemetery, where there are a few very fresh graves.
Together we'll explore the history, identity and traditions of the Tatars.
A Tatar not being a Muslim? I think that cannot be.
The Muslim minority that has lived in Poland for around 600 years.
I am a descendant of Colonel Krzyżkowski, but my roots are documented all the way back to 1397.
Our quest will take us to remote parts of Poland.
It's like we walked into a tourist trap.
But also into libraries and into meetings with Tatars from all walks of life.
They would say that we should be more devout, pray five times a day, and they would suggest that I climb the minaret and make the call to prayer along with the imam. But they have accepted us. Even when I tell them that my wife is Catholic, and that my daughter is Catholic, and my son is a Muslim.
Yeah, we have to get this history right.
Listen at tatarpodcast.eu or search for Tatars in Poland on your favorite podcast platform.
I will ask you about something I wanted to start asking people in my podcast, so you'll be the first.
Okay.
What's one easy thing that people can do to support Palestinians, but in relation to your work? So let's say space, coloniality, checkpoints. And we mentioned a bit that you can check the companies that take part, that profit basically from doing business there. But I would say for a layperson on an everyday basis, it's actually time consuming maybe to do research on their own. But do you have some other ideas?
Yeah, I don't want to preach, but I mean, but apart from BDNS, which is really important.
Boycott, divestment, sanctions, very important.
Obviously, we've seen a change. I mean, I live in the UK, I'm from the UK, and we've seen a change in the last, I would say, 18 months, where people who didn't before have much of an opinion about Palestine, they would say, oh, it's too complicated, both sides, blah, 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 and now have a very clear opinion. We see it on the streets. And that really shows how authoritarian our governments have become, because if you imagine a referendum in, at least in the UK, maybe in Poland too, to say, do you think the occupation should continue? I'm really sure it would be massively no. But our governments continue to support it and therefore deny our democratic right. So I think this change, and if I want to use like my dad, for example, you know, knows his stuff, great politics, never really had a really strong opinion on Palestine, but now knows his stuff. Like, just read loads of things. There's lots of documentaries now talking to his friends about it. So I think just for, as you say, layperson, just talking about it, it normalizing the view that this occupation that's been going on since 1948, so what is that, 77 years? Denormalizing the fact that that's the case, that being informed about how many settlers there are in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, 750,000, 750,000 people, and they're building them. They're still building them. They're talking about peace, but they're still building settlements. And then knowing things like that's against the Fourth Geneva Convention. And if you occupy a land, you're not allowed to settle your own population. Because there's not really an argument against that. And so it stops the, yeah, but well, Israel can do this, has a right to defend itself, has a right to do X, Y, and Z.
And everything started on 7th of October.
That kind of thing. Like, I think just having this, it's kind of basic knowledge, but changing the discourse. I think the discourse is changing, but I think we could just change it a little bit more. And so
you can actively participate in changing that.
Yeah, public discourse. And I don't know, how can we not care about this? How can we just keep looking away from it after what we've seen in Gaza in the last 2 years? I don't need to ask you that question. I'm just asking myself that question. It's been truly terrible.
How can we not see that and look away? That's a great finished podcast.
Well, I want to thank you for being interested in the book, and maybe you'll read it.
I will. I'm not really sure.
It's always a bit odd when somebody's interested in something that, you know, you write. So thanks for that. And I wouldn't be a hopeful person in general anyway, but the current ceasefire, you know, it shouldn't be that it's imposed by the perpetrators of genocide. And it should involve people being held to account. If they've got an ICC arrest warrant, they should be going to court to stand trial. But let's remember, this is a point where, and this is what at least the people I know in Gaza are saying, that at least they can breathe for these days and hopefully the weeks and months and years and rebuild. So we're in a better place than we were 2 weeks ago, at the very least. So what else is there to say?
Yeah, definitely. At least that. On the other hand, my call to action, I think, at the end would be to not turn away our gaze now, because people are still being killed in both Gaza, West Bank, and also other places in the world. And politicians making a deal doesn't really mean that this is the end to violence. It didn't end the occupation. It didn't end the colonization. It didn't give the land back to the people. So it's not done, finished, and it's not time for all of us to rest yet. It's just also maybe a breathing space.
Yeah.
And with that almost positive remark, thank you so much for the conversation.
Thank you, Eva.
And for the book. And I will link the link to bookstores that sell your book on the website of the podcast at www.reorient.pl. Bye. Thank you for listening to Reground. If today's conversation sparked something for you, whether it's a question, a thought, or a new perspective, I'd love to hear about it. You can drop me a line at regroundpodcast@proton.me. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with someone who might want to hear it. You can also buy me a coffee at buycoffee.to/reground. Every contribution helps keep this podcast independent and accessible to everyone. Until next time.